Accession number 28416, Reel 3.
Bill, you were telling me that you line up your aircraft upwind of the...
It's on, is it?
Yes. Upwind of the beacon.
You've got to cross the beacon.
Yes.
Preferably in a direction in which you know you can carry on flying. Either north, south, east or west, I mean, you set it up. And it tells you when you go overhead. So that you know you've arrived home, but you've just got to get down. So at that point you set up this 200 feet a minute rate of descent, very slowly coming down, and just wait for a lovely hiss on the back end and you're there. That's what he said. And he was sitting in his wheelchair, he's on a wheelchair, this chap, and his memory was perfect on all that. And afterwards, 50 years for him since he did it, but it came out, knowledge. We didn't have that knowledge.
Yes.
And the Aussies, you see, they weren't even given a chance.
May we return to when you're in hospital?
Ah. Now, that was the question about when we came round, who was missing? Well, Henry was walking about then. Henry had gone through the windscreen. That hit. His face was all... blood and bits and all sorts, but he was walkabout fine. Dave Davies was in hospital like I was, just the same, but he could walk, I think, all right then. That's the three of us, isn't it? 1, 2, 3. That's
yes.
All we've got. That's all that's left of our crew in German hands by then, we find. I mean, I woke up in hospital and lovely nurses there, and then you hear that, well, the Germans are in command now. News to me. I mean, I was sitting up there in my machine gun post. That's how the time goes by.
How long were you in hospital for?
I don't really honestly know. I mean, I hadn't got any records, but I think it was 10 days later that we actually set off for the next camp, as it were.
Yes.
Which was Corinth Canal, was another camp. I think we went there within just a few days. I don't know how many days. Well, I could tell you the date more, because when it happened, because Crete was then being attacked by the Germans. Because when we got to Corinth, there were all these Ju-52s by the 100 going off somewhere. So that must have been about a month after we got to Kalamata, I should think. It wasn't long after Kalamata. And from Corinth, which is the first place I can remember having something to eat. Which, dear old Henry, he raked up some more Aussies, and they'd got some, you know, sort of scones you can buy with raisins in. They found I suppose somebody brought them a bucket full in from outside somewhere. And we had something nice to eat. It's a bit of a memory, really. I've liked scones ever since. And everybody was in this camp, but nobody escaped from it. And the next thing was the walk from Corinth up to... wait a minute. Yes, after Corinth, somehow we went to Athens, but on from there we went to this long walk up valleys with villages and hill houses, lovely little houses, thatched roofs they seem to be, but they all had these creeping nests on their roof, and it makes me think of your swans out there when I picture them, because it was all these...
Storks.
Got it in one. Storks nests on every cottage, and we were walking up them. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, Mount Olympus. So you walk up and over Mount Olympus.
Well, it couldn't be up it, really, could it?
Well, walk in the vicinity.
It felt like it.
And
this was, yes.
At what point are you put on a train, or?
Well, I was coming to that. That's the next thing. But I'm trying to name the station that we left from. But it's got to be Thessalonica or something like it. They didn't have names, these camps. They were just usually barracks, or, you know, Greek barracks. Oh, Greek barracks. Oh, the dreadful things they are. No, I mustn't talk about that, must I?
Say whatever you like.
Well, talk about civilization. I think the Greeks were a bit behind on barracks. Their bogs were huddled on the floor. On the floor. In the floor. Full stop.
Yes.
Yeah, well, I'll leave that, because this is where I met Jack, you see, before we went on the train.
Jack Best.
Jack Best. And it's worth mentioning because our trip round to Africa in the first place had been a bit of a sort of mucky thing, because the boat, one of the Durban Castle sort of boats, pre-war, they took on a crew of about 400 West Africans on the way around, who were a pioneer corps going to India to work in India, and they lived on deck, and of course they had no bogs on deck, and the nearest holes they could find were down the drain pipes of when water comes over the ship and gets against the gunwales and goes down. Of course they got blocked, so we being British felt less of it, can't leave things like that, chaps, so we set about clearing those. This is on the way to Rhodesia, you appreciate.
Yes.
And so when Greece was like that too, we weren't surprised, we just got on with it and poked it clear. However, Jack Vest and myself had that same instinct, we can't leave a thing like that. It's like leasing rubbish on the road, you want to pick it up. And how Jack and I have got together, really. Should I tell you about Jack Vest and how he arrived in... Because he's such a part of Colditz and Sargon and Bath.
Yes, tell me something about Jack.
Well, Jack Vest, he was farming in Kenya at the war. He'd been schooled in England, but he farmed out there. And he joined Flying Club in Nairobi and learned to fly. And then when the war came, he joined the RAF VR and learned to fly in Iraq, actually, at... name for that too, but the airfield in Iraq. We know donkey's years, ours. And we met up because he eventually got on to Maryland's. He had to fly right across Africa from where they shipped them to the Gold Coast, put them together, as they did, same with American Harvards, a lot of Harvards. And then they were flown across the continent and up to the war front. And Jack went across to West Africa to bring his Maryland cross. Now, that was a wonderful thing for him because he'd done his training in Iraq. He got his wings, but he hadn't really gotten experience. So his experience of being put on the other side of Africa with a brand new aeroplane and to bring it then to the squadron, that's a better way of making useful crews. And he became a skipper straight away. Because of that trip, he'd done whatever it is across there. Quite a tricky trip, but very successful. And he was a Maryland squadron at Abu Keir in Egypt. And they would go off, like we did from Malta, they'd go off from their end. And one day their trip was to go to Malta, to old Jack and his Maryland, and his crew. I don't know, only three, I think, on board, I'm not sure. He'd never mentioned his crew much. And... he got nearly to one of the things that crops up on the way up. Jack Vest, he's setting off in his Maryland, I don't know the squadron number, to fly up to get near Greece and go along towards Italy, Sicily, and then turn for Malta. And he set off to do that. And when they hadn't anything in sight, they called up Malta, because they had long-range radio, but, you know, it had to be more stout. So you had a wireless operator, not a talkie-talk. And they gave him a bearing, which in fact turned him round. He thought, God, I must have overshot. And you can't really know whether you've overshot somewhere, of course, because you can't see it. And so he turned round. And it wasn't too long before he came across these great big Greek mountains and saw them and realised that that wasn't Malta, it wasn't Sicily, it must be the whole of that coastline somewhere, Yugoslavia or Greece. I think it was Yugoslavia probably. And the fuel ran out, of course, or was about to, when he put it down in the water by the shore and scrambled ashore with his crew. So he didn't get there. Just to add to a bit of fun to the story, he says later he met somebody in a mess somewhere in, goodness knows, it must have been a German camp, who said, well, I was in Malta at that time and heard your call come in, or saw it written down, and couldn't send out a message saying, well, watch it, that isn't the right way. So this chap knew about it, but Jack didn't. However, Jack ended up in Germany with us on the train, and our train set out from Salonika, shall we say, and it came out through Yugoslavia. One remember seeing the Blue Danube. I think in Belgrade it stopped, and the kind people were the way you were going through the country. They throw loaves of bread into the. There's a great long train load, I mean. The threat was that if anybody escaped from any carriage, ordinary carriages, not at this point cattle trucks, anybody escapes, the ten will be shot, those that are left in the carriage. A young German Leutnant, I should think, had the job of getting this gang of people up there. So there was this threat that if you don't escape, you're likely to get shot because somebody else did escape. Which is the only time I've heard that said, actually. But it was said, and you could believe that they would do it too. So we arrived at this place, which ended up at Biberach, which I mentioned on the trip down here. Yeah, straight to Biberach. There was one naval commander. He was the navigator of the Gloucester, which had been sunk during the process of Germans taking Crete. But Roger Heap, he came up with us as the representative of the Navy, and there were Dickie Edge, Henry and Jack. That's the three of us, I think, who came up with Dickie Edge. Oh, and Davies. Davies is still with us. So our crew was four, and Dickie Edge, who was a navigator on Blenheims during the whole of the Greek War. Dickie Edge, yes. His name cropped up often in escaping stories after the war, we were taken. Yes. Should we stop at that point?
Happily. So we've arrived at Biberach, and that would be mid-41 now.
Let's try and get a date for that. I can only date it because it's after Dunkirk.
Everything is after Dunkirk.
Everything's after Dunkirk, yes. I couldn't put a date on it. It was summery, though.
Let's say summer 41.
Yes, that's okay. Summer 41. And there we can picture ourselves walking into this, four of us, thinking of just the four of us. And I don't know whether everybody came into this camp from this train load, I mean. And met up with all these people who had been fighting at Dunkirk. Until they were all overpowered. So that wasn't I think they'd been there long enough to get settled in and to know the ropes, and had the Germans pretty well worked out. They didn't look too battered or starved or anything. And in fact, the most noticeable thing about the place was they had a sort of party. I think parcels used to come in. Red Cross parcels could have come in at that speed, I don't know. Because they set up it would be called a super store nowadays, a sort of trade things in and within the camp, you know, I'll swap my chocolates for your raisins sort of thing. And I don't know why I can remember that, except that it was there. I can see a condensed milk sitting up on your windowsill there that somebody had put there, condensed milk. However, they were all fairly normal sort of people. A great number came up with us New Zealanders, and we were mostly with them. And they were all being gunners, actually, at the Greek campaign. And, nobody was worried, really. I mean, they all knew that we always won the war anyway. We're bound to. We always do. However long it takes. There wasn't much escaping going on that we knew about, but we didn't know anything, really, because it was a big camp. But this was the first point at which we thought of escape. Rather like that film we were talking about on the way up here. We could see the mountains of Switzerland so clearly that it's a natural view to go and picture how easy it would be to get there, if you can get out. So the thoughts of escaping were entirely as they came out to you yourself. There was no organisation about it that we know of. And it was easy to picture that I remember thinking, the Wright brothers sort of set us to target, really. We've got plenty of wood. We've got all short, you'd have beds. I don't know if it was bunks or just probably double decker bunks, I can't remember that. But you had lengths of wood about like that anyway. And it wouldn't be too difficult to make up a panel of wing and brace it, and hang a tail on the back, and have a great long rope. There's a bit of rope, there's a bit of rope. From a big camp, enormous wire around it. And on a nice windy day, night probably, moon I should think, wind blowing, we can lay out the cord, put the glider on the end, do what Cody did in Farnborough in 1910, go up, just go up. And then if you stuff the nose down and can turn back quick enough, you're outside the camp. Those were the first thoughts about having a glider. So there was nothing new in Colditz 4 years later to think about it. But we got moved quite soon. The Air Force got moved. The Germans were so organised, and they always concentrated similar things in similar places. If you were Navy, you went to the Navy camp. Yeah. So we were sent to an RAF camp, which was actually Stalag Luft 1 on the sea at Bath, which was quite a nice journey up there. Yeah.
Where's that?
Right next to the island of Rügen, or is it Sassnitz, is the name of a town perhaps there. And it's where the Germans actually put the flying bomb designers.
So you're in Germany?
Peenemünde.
Yes, you're in Germany, not Poland.
No, we're in Germany. I think it's still Germany, yes. Denmark, Germany, Poland.
Yes.
I think Poland starts after the big port that we headed for one stage. At the far end, isn't it? Yeah. Can't think of that at the moment. Yes. Stan Luft 1. And Henry, Jack and I, we were all together, three of us still. And Davies came as well, but he was put in the sergeant's compound. Yeah. He was okay. Yeah. And as we walked in, the nightingale sang in
Berkeley Square.
Thank you. Berkeley, not Berkeley. Somebody was blowing a trumpet and playing a fiddle, and see, the war had been going on such a short time that these were all the Mike Casey, he was the first one we met. Yeah, and there's this lovely noise coming out. It sounded like going home, really. I mean, and the senior British officer was Wing Commander Day. He had a sad story, really. He was a Blenheim pilot, very accomplished pilot before the war, and he was had his Blenheims in France. Yes, in France, and their duty was to take off in France. This is before the push by the Germans. I think, yes, I'm pretty sure. Fort Maginot was lost. And they had to go to, I don't know what route it was into Germany, really, but into the big railway centres to see what's going on in the way of troop movements. Churchill always wanted to know about troop movements, didn't he? They're building up troop movements, there's something on the way, you can bet. And his squadron, with these Blenheims, the group captain said, oh yes, you better go off there tomorrow. And it's flying over Germany, perhaps in crystal clear conditions. So Wings Day said, well, I think we'll need a bit of cloud to hide in. And the group captain didn't even listen to what he said. Anyway, he went off the next day. They got just over Germany, and up had come a couple of Messerschmitts. There's no cloud at all, of course. And they shot him down. And he was the first of his squadron to go. He felt that was right, actually, because he felt, being the wing commander, you had to go first to show the route, although he didn't complete it. The idea was to go to land in England, the shorter thing. And following him was the name I gave them. Oh, come on. Gone again, you see. Just a moment, please. Yeah. That should be the name that is on there.
So Mike Casey was the...
Mike Casey was... No, he was the first person we met. I'm not sure he was playing the trombone, because he wasn't... hadn't got in his hand, but he could have been. But it was a lovely band, anyway. Yes. Oh, no, sorry. Gone quiet.
You're talking about Wing Commander Day.
Well, his second Blenheim pilot was
Mike Casey.
Mike Casey. He also was shot down. Mm. And I think it was the third, the next day, and there's another one gone down. This is the RAF at war. Asking the impossible of people, expecting the impossible. Really, no chance. I mean, daylight over Germany, Blenheim this fast. Messerschmitt that fast. However, it happened, and it's so early days, they've got to find out about casualties, haven't they? Have to put up with them. But dear old Mike, I mean, I've got to say what happened at the end, because, I'll leave it till the end, why not? Yeah, he was an Irishman, lovely Irishman. He welcomed us, he put us in a room, said, that's your room, three of you, four of you. And there, where we cooked up the idea of... There was escaping going on there. There were only thoughts about escape, more than there had been at the big Dunkirk camp. Because it looked so easy. It was a very small, wild encampment, and the huts were so near to the boundary, you think you could almost jump over the wall from where you are. And one... I was in the winter when the snow is quite deep. One chap said, well, I'm going to take off all my clothes and tunnel through the snow, which is deep enough up to the wire that they won't see me, and out the wire and over the top in the middle of the night. I don't think he really meant to go with no clothes on, but he gave that impression. That was Panton. I remember his name. He and poor chaps was a... Do you remember the... the ambassador, the reconnaissance monoplane, high wing, wheels like this, didn't have any bombs or anything, that they were expected to go reconnaissance over Germany in single seaters. Flew out of Old Sarum, it was their base, made in Yeovil. Yeovil, come on, name of the Yeovil. You see, the name is so simple, I can't tell you what it is.
Let's not worry too much. If you lose the names, let's not worry about it. Let's continue with the story. Just continue with the story.
Well, okay. I was trying to picture who the people were there. There's the Wingsday and his Blenheim. There's Panton, went under the snow. His aeroplane was... I can't get it. Can we have a stop? Not all bright and cheerful. But it was... And that's where we met Germans for the first time who spoke English. Herr Pieber. Herr Pieber? Is that a name I ever heard of?
Maybe.
Herr Pieber. Other interviews, I mean?
I haven't, no.
Well, Herr Pieber, he was in the Air Force, because the Air Force guarded the Air Force, the Luftwaffe guarded us. And he was Austrian, and he had perfect English, and he was a reasonable guy.
What sort of escaping was going on at Stalag Luftwaffe?
Well, it was this immediate escape process. You either pretend not to be there. I missed out on the chap who got away on the walk to the mountain, but never mind. Mm-hmm. They were thoughts that it's such a small place, you're walking around the camp, as you always walk around the camp, but this time when you get to that point you go straight to the sentry box. Let's say, sorry, I mustn't do that. You go straight to the sentry box, up underneath the chap in the camp, above it, don't bother, there's room underneath to get through, down the other side and away. And old Twinker Hill did that. He actually got out by such a quick... I mean, it's all over in a minute, which is a wonderful way to escape. The chap I mentioned on the walking route, I'm trying to explain how to escape if you have a chance. You're walking along right down the road, and roads have ditches sometimes, and they have gates going into fields. And if you pick the right gate that's got a little culvert underneath it, and you can get into that, they'll march on while you stay under your culvert. So long you ask somebody to say, well, when the German behind me isn't looking at me, sing a song or do something, and I'll dive in there. So you're walking in front of me there, German, or I'm behind, and suddenly somebody's singing a song, right there, in the culvert, gone. I saw it happen. I was right there. I thought, what a wonderful way. He's gone, he's escaped. Never heard of him since, but he escaped. And that's what Trinker did, going there, up and over and out. Other escapes, tunnelling was always going on, of course. You always hope to tunnel your way out. But the snag with tunnelling is, everybody finds, you don't know where to put the stuff you've dug out. Now, the only people who do know the answer to that one are the moles. Because a mole leaves his little pile of stuff on the surface. Well, if you left on the surface, you're telling the Germans where you are. So you don't leave it on the surface. Well, I had this idea come to me that, if you can dig something about, shall we say, if there's two of you, 12 feet long, and get rid of 12 feet of sand, which you can under your floorboards, you haven't got to take it anywhere else, out of the room even. And then you get in it, and then your mates block up this end and put the floorboards back. You're underground, as per mole. And you just go, you've only got so far to go. And there, you only head right from here to your door over there.
That's about 12, 15 feet most.
Mm. Well, it's a bit more than that. I'm picturing 12 feet got us to about there. But you're a quarter of the way before you start, and then you've got that to do. And that mole scheme was approved by Mike Casey. Mike was also the escape officer at Bath One. And he said, yes, that's a good scheme. But then we got moved.
Where you moved to?
Well, this is Jack, Best and myself, with Henry. We're all moved with... I think the whole of Bath went, actually, on this new train journey, down to Sargon Stanagloff 3, by dreadful name. And that was summer of... I wonder when it was.
Summer 42?
Summer 40...
Must be 42.
Were we there at Christmas? Must be 42, I should think.
Summer 42.
Yes. Anyway. Oh, well, early. It might have been the end of 41. It could have been, because it was the June the 22nd, 42, that we got out of Sargon. And we only had about 6 months there, I think.
All right.
Time, roughly that, anyway.
Sargon is Stalagluf 3.
Sargon is Stalagluf 3, yes, which was built as the main RAF camp.
Yes.
To which everybody was...